Hey, I want to announce an important birth date of Peter Leibovich, a dear friend of the show, a great labor leader in Canada, well known from one ocean to the other, and he passed away and not so long ago. July 25th is his birthday. 25th, we'll be doing Friday morning, and we'll have something to say about him at that time on that occasion. And I think I've already announced that there's going to be something at the different book lists Thursday the 25th, and it's the authority on... Her name is Carolyn Cooper, and she has written a new book, Global Reggae, and that's Thursday, 7 p.m. at 746 Bathurst. And I think we're joined now by someone from Gaza's Ark. I started to say Ork. I'm very sorry. And it's David Heap. Are you there, David?
Hi, Phil. Yes, David Heap here.
Hey, now you at Gaza's Ark, you've been doing really dramatic work, and it's such a brilliant idea to buy and refurbish a boat, and then instead of importing, coming into Gaza, you decided to sail out. Wonderful project. But lately you've had some problems just because the whole region that you're operating in are having problems. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been an adventure all along. It's been more than a year now. We launched the campaign a year ago, May, in 2012, and it took us a year to make the initial purchase because we were raising funds, but also because nobody had ever done anything like this before in Gaza. And, you know, we were just getting sort of hitting our stride in the rebuilding renovation process when, one predictable thing happened, which is everything in the region slows down a bit for Ramadan. And then one not so predictable thing happened, which was the coup in Egypt. And, of course, the only viable border for most Palestinians in Gaza is the one crossing at Rafah with mm-hmm. Egypt. So mm-hmm. the only place people can get out on their, think of a prison with a day pass system, right?
Yeah.
A temporary pass system. But also the only supply line in for most supplies are the tunnels at Rafah. And, initially after the coup, both were completely shut off. Now there's sort of opened to a trickle, but it's still very restricted.
I suppose that Egypt, actually, of course, is experiencing a actual dangerous political trauma. It's terrible for the Gazans, but you can understand there must be fear and anxiety about what might happen around that area when nobody's quite sure of how the power arrangement's going to work out in Cairo, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that there's all kinds of insecurity in Egypt is not a surprise to anybody and on all sides. But what the tragedy of it is whatever happens in Egypt, it's the Palestinians of Gaza that end up paying the price.
Mm-hmm.
As people would say in some places, you know, if Egypt sneezes, Gaza Palestinians in Gaza get the cold.
Mm.
It's more than just sort of a security consequence. There's been a demonization in some of the Egyptian press of those terrible Palestinians who are causing trouble, because they identify the government that's in power, the Hamas government with the Muslim Brotherhood that was deposed in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Even if that was true, it's a question as everything else about the blockade, it's a matter of collective punishment. I mean, you can't
yes.
punish 1.7 million people because of who some of them happen to vote for for their government, and especially and increasingly so when more than half of those 1.7 million people are 19 or younger and never voted for anybody anywhere.
Yeah.
It's illegal in international law to collectively punish any population, but particularly close to my heart are all those young people in Gaza who are being made to suffer for things that they have no control over, right? Not
yeah.
that most of the civilian population has the control over their government at any time.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of our project, it makes things difficult, you know, getting supplies, prices, as any time like this, prices go crazy and with speculation and supplies dry up. We did have some people who were traveling for technical support. I mean, in June, we had a wonderful experience. One of the Swedish sailors from the Estelle, so the Swedish ship to Gaza last year, a sailor from Gothenburg in Sweden, who was, he sailed last all of last summer for months, and then, like everybody else, like Jim Manley from Canada, they were kidnapped on the high seas, and they were taken to prison in Israel and then deported. And Charlie Andreessen just said, well, when he got out of prison, he said, I'm going back to work on the Ark. So he went back and spent most of the month of June in Gaza, you know, just helping out as a volunteer on the technical side of the rebuild. Because we're talking about, in a sense, a very simple people, like sailors with technical, practical skills, but also very, very committed people.
Yeah,
so
you
have
some...
get in June. He was able to get in June. We had somebody else coming in July, and, of course, they can't get in now, and there's other people who can't get in and out. But this is... I mean, this is a small problem for internationals. This is, it's a very, very large problem for Palestinians.
Yeah,
I mean,
I noticed that you point that out in the at GazaArk.org that you say, well, we're just learning to experience this. This is a day-to-day life for Palestinians in Gaza.
Day-to-day, year-to-year.
Welcome to Gaza.
Exactly. This has been their life since the blockade now, so, you know, coming up on, 6 years here of the blockade, but also even before that, restrictions on movement is part of the Palestinian reality under occupation, you know, and when we talk about the sea blockade, it's one aspect of restrictions on freedom of movement, and let's not forget that, you know, pass laws and the ability to move around your country or the inability to move around your country were a pillar of South African apartheid, and they are a pillar of the Israeli occupation throughout Palestine. So while we focus here on the sea blockade, it is just the most acute case of restrictions on freedom of movement for Palestinians in general everywhere.
Yeah. Could you talk about this sailor? You have one of those, maybe, I don't know if he is a sailor, yes, the one who lost his hand.
Okay,
I mean, because, you know, you guys are providing, there's work too. I mean, this is, for him, it must be great.
It's not a huge project, so it's not like we're a big aid organization, and the exports will be very modest as well, but yeah. Samuel Goga is a former fisherman who, like most of the, well, all of the fishermen who are still working in Gaza, and many of them have given up because they can't make a living at it. But the boat he used to work on was attacked, by the Israeli Navy for, you know, the crime of trying to earn a livelihood by fishing. His injuries led to his hand being amputated. So he couldn't work, previously and support his family, and he's now working as a guard on the boat. And you know, another boat builder, young guy with a young family, is employed. Sammy the name now. Sorry, there's a series on our site, so I'll take the opportunity to send people to
Mustafa.
Mustafa. He's got a young family as a boat builder who wasn't able to get much work boat building and is now working on the project. So there are, you know, in all, depending on exactly what work we're doing, there could be 4, 5, 6 people working on that, and of course families who depend on that, working on the project at any given time. So it's, as I say, it's not a huge employment project, but one of the differences here is the money that we're raising is being spent in Gaza on the reconstruction of this ark. So it's really, if people want to think about it, it's really a victory for the Palestinians of Gaza even before we sail, right? The fact that we're doing something there that with them that hasn't been done before, which is rebuilding a boat in the port of Gaza with the intention of sailing out with export.
And it's both not only a political, but it's a practical issue, and it's a wonderful illustration of what their lives could be like if they were not being molested by an alien naval force and permitted to live their lives and to export their goods. This is something, by the way, we all look forward to. And you are making progress. People can go to Gaza.
GazaArk.org.
GazaArk. I got to look at things when I say them. GazaArk.org. And you can actually see the progress of the work on that boat.
Yep, the sanding, the steel reinforcement, the painting, you know, the scraping and cleaning. Soon you should be seeing, hopefully, I don't want to put a time on it, but we'll say soon there should be steel reinforcements going on because it's a traditional wooden hull. Mm-hmm. And to make it ready for a sea voyage, there's some steel reinforcement going in. So it's quite exciting, the work that's going on and the technical ingenuity going into, in a place where every piece of supplies is hard to come by, you know, where they found ways to, they couldn't find new steel tanks for the fuel, but they've found some recycled ones which are being repurposed. So, you know, there are solutions that can be found with ingenuity and with international support.
Yeah.
When you talk about the life, the economy they could have, we should also talk about the producers, right? So the the Ahliya, the people's date producers organization, is keen to sell their date products. And I was actually just on a Skype call with a young man there who's very excited about stuff from the Jabalia Women's Cooperative in one of the camps in northern Gaza Strip, who are making some crafts, some armbands, and other items that they're keen to sell to as exports on the ship. So you know, this is a way soon that organizations and businesses in Canada and around the world will be able to get on board and say, we'll take some of the risk, we'll buy goods, because we have confidence in the economy of the Palestinians of Gaza.
Yeah, that's a great story. So if people go to the site, GazaArk.org, this is a chance for people to get in. They can make contributions to the people who are doing this solidarity work and build and help pay for this boat, right?
Yep. You can make a number of different kinds of contributions. There's people who are buying shares, so symbolic shares in the Ark. There's folks who
you can own part of the Ark.
You can be part owner. It doesn't have a big stock market value, perhaps, but it is of great symbolic value. Let's put it that way. There's people who are contributing specific material items. So we just had somebody who donated part of the firefighting system. U.S. person who donated part of the firefighting system. She said in memory of her father, who was a first responder to 9/11.
Wow! So that is a gee, I hope you post that story at Gaza Ark. That's a good one.
That's on our Facebook page. I can't keep track of all the stuff that's going on Gaza Ark. And people are also donating towards just as refurbishing the Ark. So there's people donating towards the wages of the workers, because that's one of our ongoing expenses, is just paying for the folks who are doing this work.
Well, and
so there's different ways of getting involved. And then later on, well, pretty soon we hope, we will have orders of products. And there, again, we need organizations or businesses who are willing to sort of put together a group order in the different countries and communities that are ready to support this.
Well, I know some businesses right here. I'm going to go approach them about this, because I know that it would be good for their stores. David Heap, congratulations on all your great work. I love going to the GazaArk.org site and seeing all the interesting people and the progress. It's something I know people can get behind. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for letting your listeners know. It's always a great pleasure to talk to you, Phil.
All right, David. Thank you. Bye-bye. That's David Heap. And it's GazaArk.org. You can go to that site and get in on the activity. And they particularly need help to buy, help purchase supply and to pay the labor. And so I urge everybody to do it. I always look at this as Gaza. They have a very nice, I guess you call it a logo, Gaza's Ark on the logo of Freedom Flotilla. That's where we first heard of them. They were going sailing from Cyprus. And actually one ship, I think, went from Scandinavia. We made a long, long trip there. And, of course, there was the legendary Turkish vessel that was fired upon. This is a very creative approach. You're listening to The Taylor Report. It's CIUT, 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. We have a website, taylor-report.com. I could tell you we posted I'm going to call it a declaration on what we think is going on in Syria. So if you go to Taylor-Report, you will see that we seem to be on the same page with Mahdi Nazim Roya. And I'll quote you the proverb that we cite there, which is that Syria has been confronted, of course, by sheikhs in the Gulf and kings who thought they were going to overthrow them by dividing them and is trying to create sectarian warfare. The New York Times joined in, the Globe and Mail and others said, oh, it's a sectarian war. It's not at all. It's mercenaries who are posing as one sect or another to create havoc. The government of Syria has not taken a sectarian position, and that's pretty important to underline, and that's why so far they have survived, in my opinion. And, of course, now they're up against Mr. Cameron, who's worried about going to be the new heir apparent, so he can't be distracted as an 8-pound new apparent. summon the goat that he can bow before. And then there's Mr. Obama, who's occupied. But they all, each of them has a little plan to try to overthrow the sovereign government of Syria. And the proverb is, this old anvil laughs at many broken hammers. They can plan all they want. But the Syrian people are going to be there. I know, no matter what they throw at them. You're talking about an ancient people. And so they've had... I remember seeing a film once about the history of Libya, and an Italian fascist was parading around in Tripoli, and he was giving a lecture, and there was an Arab gentleman listening to him, and he said, "Well, the reason we're here, of course, is we belong here. We found just this morning, one of my officers found a Roman coin," and the Arab said, "We have a lot of coins. You can look all you like. This is our country. Yes, there are many coins here." Which is, by the way, very important to note. There is an old trick of saying, "Oh, I found a cross, or I found an ancient piece of an old temple. Therefore, I'm going to rule about the next, several thousand square miles." Anyhow, this is Data Report, CIT 89.5 FM. We were talking prior to I want to thank Phil, who's here, Phil Conant. Of course, we pointed out there have been about 90 really prominent authors who have signed a statement calling on the Israeli government not to violate international law and the rights of indigenous peoples, et cetera, and forcefully remove Bedouins and Palestinians in a particular area under Israeli control. And so many of our greatest authors are involved, Ondaatje and Margaret Atwood, et cetera. And it just makes me realize again that we have a parliament full of zombies who don't say anything. And here, but people who really speak for our culture. I mean, if we're going to be known for anything, it's these writers and artists. It shows it's a light that you can point towards Israel, but also sheds a light on ourselves. And why don't we have any parliamentarians with similar qualities of character and integrity? And that's time. That'll be for another show. But now we have to segue here because Phil and I initiated a discussion. Phil is an authority on the rail business, as we've established before. We won't go into that. But I asked a question of Phil before the show, which is I read a report that there those looking into the terrible disaster at Megantic, why there was a fire. And apparently that's a big question now for the investigators. This was not the kind of material one would expect a fire from. So, Phil, could you tell us what you found out?
Well, this issue has arisen. And, of course, the longer the investigation goes on, the more and more complex issues about what exactly happened to cause that catastrophe. More issues come to the fold. Of course, the owner of the railway was very quick to blame the worker. That's usually the fallback position of
that's the first thing out of the mouth of the boss.
Yeah, the guy screwed it up. But yeah. One of the issues that I understand there's several investigations going on. There's fire authorities. There's a police investigation. There's the National Transportation Agency investigation. There's the railroad's own internal investigation. But one of the questions that has quietly been coming out is why exactly would crude petroleum oil have been so explosive? It's not one of the properties for which it's known. And there is no answer to that question as of yet. But it did one of the theories that's being posited, and if there's anything to it, it is very, very troubling, is that this is fracked oil. Fracking is a new technology. It's basically a technology to take oil that would not make economic sense to mine unless you do all kinds of dangerous things. That the oil, in fact, had had other substances in it that had been pumped into the well in order to get it more easily to come out of the ground, and that the railway's waybill would not have reflected that fact. And I find that very, very troubling. I worked on the railway for 35 years, and I was often involved with documentation of freight. And over that period of time, of course, we saw many, many changes when it came to how things were classified, how dangerous commodities were considered, and how they were moved and what the rules around them were. But one thing which I never ever saw was not being able to safely make the assumption that what was in a rail car is what the shipper said was in the rail car. And if it turns out that the people shipping this said this was petroleum oil and it was adulterated and they didn't tell anybody, that is that's so horrifying, and that would be a whole new area of inquiry.
But could we be in an area where they don't think that's necessary? In other words,
For sure they don't think. They don't think any government regulation is necessary.
When you say adulterated, yeah. Somebody has to kind of, the light has to go on for them when they're saying, well, okay, then we got it here, or we transfer it there, we put it in a car.
Yeah.
Does somebody say, well, wait a minute, we're just learning about what fracking is. By the way, it was fracked in North Dakota. Shipped through Canada, then back into the U.S. in Maine.
And eventually to end up back in Canada.
Is it really?
Yes, to the Irvings. This is the Irvings oil.
Oh.
The Irvings own this
oil. I didn't know Irving was involved.
Irvings involved. So it would have come out of North Dakota on a Canadian Pacific train. It would have crossed at Windsor. It went through downtown Toronto, went through the core of the city of Montreal, where it was handed off to the Montreal Main Atlantic Railway, which used to, whose tracks used to be part of Canadian Pacific, but that's one of the things railways do.
It's the same track.
Well,
it's just
had
a new name.
I mean, I have a map I'm going to give you, Phil, of all of the small railways in the state of Maine.
Our listeners are really going to find that map interesting. You notice this part?
Well, okay, so people can find it on the net. Go to the Montreal, Maine, and Atlantic Railway and look at their network map and see how many railways you never heard of, because they're all tiny, right, interconnect and all this sort of stuff. And the reason for that is that the big railways, they make their money on hauling things on the main line, and then they're really, it's a little harder to make money on the smaller parts. So they sold those parts off, and but they are ultimately responsible for the whole movement of this train. This train was going to go back into the United States from whence it came, and then it was going to re-enter Canada in New Brunswick, and it was going to go to a terminal in St. John, which, by the way, went right at the port of St. John, and of course, if it exploded
there. Well, okay, then what happens in St. John? What happens next?
Well, it's going to be refined.
Refined, and then just...
that's right. And then, by the way, the rail cars all get returned to do it again, right? And when it works well, they get unloaded fairly quickly. But I'm not saying, because nobody knows that something happened
but
there.
But they do know that they were. Everybody seems to be surprised at the fire.
Absolutely,
because they said that is not a product that should have.
That should have burned like that.
One would have expected.
Now, there could have been something right there where the stuff leaked onto that, who knows? I mean, we don't know, and of course, there's a lot of speculation on it, but it would be a very troubling development. But it would not surprise me, because at one time, railways were extremely highly regulated in Canada and in the United States, and then Ronald Reagan got the bright idea that we really don't need to regulate them all that much, and so Canada said, we'll do the same thing here, and there's been less and less regulation. And even the owner of the Montreal, Maine, and Atlantic is sitting there and saying, "Yeah, the whole place blew up and everything like that." But I think more government regulation is a bad idea. It's not going to help. Well, with all due respect, Mr. Ed, you're the last person who should have an opinion on this subject.
Yes, it's kind of like your dog bit my. And so now I'm going to regulate your dog. Yeah. It was on my property. Well, Phil, thanks very much for that. We will keep following that. So we're going to stay on that subject until somebody gives us accounts for that, among the other many other things. I want to make sure I announce that a regular guest on our show every year is Cynthia Hess von Kreudner. Her husband was Major von Kreudner, and he was a Canadian Army officer who was serving as a UN seconded to the United Nations at the time of the Israeli attack on Lebanon. If I got my year right, it was 2009, I think. It might have been six.
No, it's longer than 2009.
It's 2006.
Yeah, 2006,
I'm sorry.
2006, yeah.
And he was killed on July 25th. He and four others were at this site. What was striking about it was that it was struck several times. And it was a known UN post. And of course, the Major's widow, Cynthia, has been trying to get answers. The Canadian government made a little foray into attempting to get answers to how that could have happened. That post had been there for many, many years, and of course had been it was clearly marked. And because of the political configuration of the country, this involves an Israeli pilot and a laser-directed bomb, and it could all be rather awkward. It's like the USS Liberty ship got attacked by Israeli Navy, I think it was in 56. I'm going to get all my years right. It might have been 67. At any rate, so Cynthia Hess von Kordner is in Lebanon. She will be attending a UN gathering of families, friends, families, military attachés, etc. I would like to think that Canada is represented, but something tells me it's not. Certainly they will not have anything to say. But when she returns, we'll be talking to her to learn more about what occurred. On the matter of Detroit, I had probably a bad analogy to make, but I'm going to make it anyway. It seems to me that what is happening to black Detroit is makes it the Trayvon Martin of American municipalities. New York City had a financial terrible situation, and the mayor said to the federal government, come and help me, and they said, sure. Detroit has a problem, and they don't say, sure, they say, sink. All around Detroit, as has been pointed out by former economist serving under Bill Clinton, he said, there's white upper middle class neighborhoods doing quite well, thank you. They all function there as we know it as Detroit, but they have different names, and none of their money goes to help Detroit. If you're going to look into the judicial system that made a horror and a decision in the case of Trayvon Martin and Mr. Zimmerman, who shot him, you may as well then also have a look at the economy, which seems to be designed to crush American black population. So, at any rate, that's that matter. And I did notice also something very funny in Toronto Star. A man wrote an article about how China's coming along as an economy and it's moving towards democracy. And then he says, in Chinese bookstores, you can find Western books. And he finds that very encouraging. When I find Chinese books in our bookstores, I'll be impressed. By the way, if I go to the movie theater, I will see American movies. I mean, it's so pathetic to read this. He says that Deng Xiaoping ordered the Tiananmen massacre. Well, there wasn't, actually, to be historically correct, it was not a massacre. A neighboring street where a clash happened, and so it happened. Soldiers and police got killed as well. But they have to have this fantasy that all this took place in Tiananmen. That's for our consumption. And because we're satisfied to be dumb, we put up with it. Anyhow, this is the Taylor Report, CIUT. I thank Lyndon Johnson, Phil Conlon, and see you next week.